My name is Dory, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Joe will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experiences, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institute. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Liz will read the steps.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Liz, and I'm an alcoholic. Okay. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jeffrey will read the traditions.
My name is Jeffrey. I am an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For the group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Scott.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Scott, and I'm an alcoholic. I remember my name. So far, so good. My sobriety date is April 15th, 2008. Yes, I know, tax day. My alcoholic thinking, in the first few weeks, I actually did consider going out again just so I could have a cooler sobriety date. You know, maybe sometime in September or October. It's like, yeah, that's a good idea. 5 more months of misery and suffering just so I can have a cool sobriety date. It's a good thing I have a sponsor when I get to thinking. And his name is Todd. He told me to say that so I could get $5. Let's see. Oh, I am, AG is my home group, and I am working step 9 and living in 10, 11, and 12. So thank you, Jiro, for asking me to speak. He asked me about a month ago, so I've had this whole time to think about what I was going to say, and then the last few minutes to hopefully forget it all. So who knows what's going to come out of my mouth. But I will try to adhere to the group conscience. Reminds me of something I saw in one of the rooms. It said something along the lines of, nobody will be offended by refrain from use of profanity. I'll just try to offend you any other way I can think of. Which reminds me of the first time I got drunk. I was 16, it was a New Year's party. I was such a nerd when I was a kid. I had braces, glasses, and pimples. Should see my first driver's license picture. It's pretty sad. But anyway, so I'm with a buddy of mine. We're at this New Year's party, and There's this woman, and vodka, and so it's my first time drinking, and I remember drinking vodka and Cokes, and I think Jeff R. put it perfectly. I went from feeling like Poindexter to James Bond. Well, if James Bond said really inappropriate things and touched women in inappropriate places. You know, it's funny, at the end of all those James Bond movies, you know, they're panning out and they're, you know, James Bond and this woman are together, and she always goes, "Oh, James." With me, it was like, "Ew, Scott." So this woman, she's paying attention to me, and we're both getting drunk, and she did one of these things where, you know, she had a glass here, and there's like beer over here, some liquor here, and she just started pouring it all in a glass. I've done that. And I didn't think that was any big deal. It's just like, she was paying attention to me, that's all that mattered. And it didn't matter that she was married, and her daughter, her 9-year-old kid was there. And towards the end of the night, we were playing some strip card game. I think strip war, because poker took too long. But The sad thing was is that her daughter was dealing the cards. Yeah, I know. And it gets worse. That was just the beginning. And the only thing I could think of is, you know, let's get this kid out of here so I can score with the mom. 16, an alcoholic. So I'm going to fast forward through, you know, pain, misery, wondering why I was different, what made me different from everybody else, why I always hated myself, why I was miserable all the time, why I was always depressed, you know, why I couldn't fit in, why I always felt a part of, you know, up until I came to New York when my drinking really took off. I was living with a girl, with my girlfriend at the time, and I came home drunk one night. Surprise. And we got into this fight. I was in such a fog, I don't remember what it was about, but I know she called me a name, I called her a worse name, and then she whacked me. A really good one. It was open-handed, like right in the jaw. It wasn't a slap. I mean, it's a good thing her fist wasn't closed, because I don't think I'd be here. No, I'm kidding. It was wounded my pride more than anything. And then my crazy alcoholic thinking was, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go back to the bar. That's a good idea. And I'm not even going to put my shoes back on. I'm just going to walk back to the bar in my socks. They'll know how to take care of me. Yeah, because that's where my friends are. What a great idea. And already? Gee, and I thought I could warp time with my sobriety. So, So another knucklehead thing that I did, well, it's my bottom. It's more than knucklehead. It's when I had enough. I went out and decided to sleep with a woman who wasn't my girlfriend. And it was really strange being in that place. My mind was saying, this is a really bad idea. There's the door. Go use the door. Let's go right now. But my alcoholism kept me there. And I stayed. And I remember going home thinking, what am I going to do? Not knowing what, you know, I'm drunk, I've done like possibly the, you know, worst possible thing you could, you know, do to another human being. I mean, instead of kill them. But that's how it felt. And so a few days later, the remorse, the resentment, the guilt, the shame has had me in such a grips that I was bawling my eyes out. And the only thing I could do was to get drunk. I know we had some scotch. I drank that. Three scotches later, I was numb, and that was enough. This is where the grace of God steps in. She didn't kick me out. The relationship, I ruined it. I mean, it was over. But her dad was there. I mean, I stepped over the guy coming home. I mean, that was pretty terrible. He asked me, Scott, do you want to keep going on feeling like this? I said, no, I don't. He said, you got to get some help then. And it was the first time, like, I said, okay. And that's my saving grace, is willingness. I was seeing a therapist at the time. He said, you know, maybe you can quit drinking, maybe you can't. Oh, yeah, I tried to quit drinking once. I made it 12 whole days, just to spite a psychiatrist. I showed her. I said, okay. I was staying with a friend at the time, and she goes, well, I got a friend in the program. You want me to have her give you a call? I said, okay. Friend calls me and says, you want to go to a meeting? Okay. And then I found myself in this room. This meeting was my first meeting. Whew. Walk in that door, people in suits reaching out to shake my hand. I was like, ah. I thought I was like at an Amway meeting or something. It was really kind of weird. It's like, where are all the burnouts? Where are all the guys with the big bulbous nose and, you know, grisly faces? It's like, no, there's like all these people who look like me. And then I sat down, and then the meeting started, and I don't remember what happened, but I do remember somebody said the right thing at the right time, and it's like, this is what's been wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic. That's been my problem. And, you know, somebody was reading the steps, and they went too far, and it went on to the we are not saints thing, we don't do anything perfect, blah, blah, blah. I can't quote the big book. I'm not a big book quoter. But I was like, I don't have to do this perfectly. And it's like, it's like progress, that's it? Not perfection? Because I'm a perfectionist, you know. And that was a relief. And then I hear that again at the other meetings. It's like, you just got to try. You just got to be willing. And, you know, willingness was all where it's gotten me where I am. And I believe that God is really doing for me what I can't do for myself. Because for quite some time, I was like, I don't know, have you ever seen, like, on the street, this kid throwing a temper tantrum and the mother's, like, dragging him down the sidewalk? That's me and God. He is dragging me through this program, sometimes against my own will. Because obviously, left to my own devices, thank you. I couldn't have done this by myself. I don't have the answers. I'm not getting money out. I'm getting this really cool thing that was given to me on my first anniversary. It's called Why We Were Chosen. My dad gave this to me. So I'm just going to read this because I don't have anything else smart to say. God in his wisdom selected this group of men and women to be the purveyors of his goodness. In selecting them through whom to bring about this phenomenon, he went not to the proud, the mighty, the famous, or the brilliant. He went instead to the humble, to the sick, to the unfortunate. He went right to the drunkard, the so-called weakling of the world. Well might he have said to us, unto your weak and feeble hands I have entrusted a power beyond estimate. To you has been given that which has been denied the most learned of your fellows, not to scientists or statesmen, not to wives or to mothers, not even to my priests or ministers have I given this gift of healing other alcoholics, which I entrust to you. And I got that great opportunity on my birthday this Saturday. I got to go to Rikers Island, and I can't think of a better way to spend my birthday than with other drunks being of service to AA. So I'm out, and I'm getting goodbye. So thank you all very much for helping me stay sober today.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Christy.
Hi, my name is Christy, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Debbie for asking me to speak, and to the Atlantic Group, which is my home group, to each and every one of you who make this meeting possible, thank you, and to all of you who are here, because, you know, this is service, just showing up, and everyone being here. I think I might need this a little higher. Taller than you thought. Everyone's presence here, thank you, helps keep me sober as well. So the stats, my sober date is July 16th, 2006. Stacy's my sponsor, and I mentioned Atlanta Group is my home group. I'd like to say a big warm welcome to the newcomers. We're so glad that you're here. Welcome. If you're coming back and it's been a while, we're glad you're here as well. So, and anyone visiting. Let's see, my experience of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. There's a saying in AA, it says, more will be revealed over time. And I think one of the interesting things about that for myself is, you know, after a little bit of time, I've learned that I had very alcoholic thinking as a young child. You know, I was always had a lot of fear-based thinking, you know, which correlated to me having, you know, behaviors that were, you know, dishonest, manipulative, controlling. I was always afraid of not getting what I wanted or losing what I have. And that I've come to learn is alcoholism. So for me, that's very important, because what that means is if I stop drinking, well, and if I was a child and I had that thinking before I even took a drop of alcohol, then what that means is that even if I take the alcohol away, I'm still left with that thinking, that distorted, self-absorbed, fear-based thinking, and I need a solution. So I started drinking because I started drinking, it was probably around 15. For me, you know, it was not so much because I didn't feel a part of. I did feel pretty comfortable, and, you know, I mean, aside from the normal awkward teenage stuff, I guess, I always had friends. I felt, you know, pretty much like I fit in, but for me it was more... After my parents' divorce, there was a lot of changes. There was a lot of geographical changes. There was a lot of family dynamic changes. You know, my mom remarried a man who was a retired Navy pilot, so he had his way. He thought things should be this way and, you know, couldn't really handle this 14, 15-year-old self-entitled little princess. Needless to say, we did not mesh. We did not see eye to eye. And the only thing I really thought that was great about his presence was the fact that there was more and better alcohol in the house. So, you know, when I basically drank to escape, to avoid the pain of this new existence that, you know, I didn't really, that was hard to deal with. So I drank, and I drank a lot through high school, and the only consequences, you know, really at that point in high school were, you know, I just really started losing my motivation. I started not showing up in school. My grades were declining. I wasn't participating in sports. Just, you know, not seeing beyond the bigger picture. It was just kind of like all of a sudden I was in survival mode, you know, and at first it was fun, and it kind of got me out of my normal thought process of dealing with the changes at home, and then it just became something that I relied upon. And it continued into my 20s, into college. You know, it was like all of a sudden that's who I was. I drank, you know. I couldn't imagine going to a social function or being somewhere without alcohol, you know. And when I was in college, I remember there was a woman who lived next door to me, and someone, a friend of mine, knew her boyfriend, and he said, you know, so-and-so, Aaron's girlfriend, is an alcoholic. Maybe, you know, and I thought, he said, you know, she's sober, she doesn't drink, she's an alcoholic, you know, she's an AA, and I thought, oh, that poor woman. Like, you know, I mean, how could you go through life like that? And then A, like, B, like, why are you telling me this? You know, and so I ended up sitting with her. I don't even remember. I think I may have actually, you know, been so sick and tired of being sick and tired. At one point, I may have initiated the conversation. And I remember sitting there in her kitchen, and it's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm thinking, this woman's really serious. It's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We're not having wine. We're not having a cocktail. She's serving me tea. We're sitting here talking like this, she's really doing this, you know? And she said, you should probably come to, you know, why don't you, she shared a little bit of her experience and said, why don't you come to AA? And so I did, you know, kind of reluctantly, but also a little bit out of curiosity. And it was a women's meeting. And I remember I was just completely dumbfounded. Every woman in that meeting had, you know, up until that time, what I thought were like dirty little secrets. You know, oh, I slept with my friend's boyfriend and I cheated and I did this. It was like, what? You know? Thank you. Like, so it was good. It was good to have that, you know, it was kind of like the seed was planted, as they say. But, you know, I, at that point in time, was not ready. And I certainly did not think I was an alcoholic. Drinking problem, maybe. Alcoholic, no way. So I kept drinking, you know, and I had to go out and get some more information and do some more damage. And, you know, I just drank, and I guess the consequences at that, you know, it took a while before the consequences really kind of crept up. You know, I would go out, I would be out all night and come home at like, you know, 4 in the morning, sleep for 2 hours, get up, go to school, and set the curve for the exam. So it was like I wasn't really having at that point. It wasn't until maybe, you know, a couple of years later, and this is at this point in time, like, you know, a good 2 years after I went to that first AA meeting. And then it was in my you know, interpersonal and romantic relationships where I really started having consequences. And, you know, friendships just falling apart. People didn't want to be around me. I couldn't show up. I was, you know, lying. There was always some drama with Christy, you know. And I was in a relationship with a very nice man. We were dating for 2 years. He wanted to get married, and he said, look, Christy, you're an amazing woman, but you're a lousy drunk, and you're drunk more than you're sober, you know? And at one point, he said, you know, it's me or the alcohol, and it was like, well, you're not a very smart man, you know, because clearly. And something else happened, you know, there was another big blowout, and I, you know, tried hiding it, tried, okay, I'm going to really try to give it up, but that didn't happen. And so it just went on and on. And then I lost a job, a really good job. I think that I actually had a series of several bottoms. I really do. But, you know, the last night I was at this black tie affair with this man, and we had been drinking all day, and then the cocktails. And I remember sitting down at the dinner table, and this woman said, you know, probably better speed it up. Anyways, they looked at me and said, you know, I think you need to have some food. I think you need to eat. And I was like, who are these duds? You know, no, I'm fine. Well, then I went to the bathroom and I came back, and he said to me, you fell in the bathroom? I said, I did? I don't know. He said, yes. And he said, get up. You know, you can't be here. I have clients here. And I was like, who are you? You've been drinking just as much as I am. You have 30 pounds, whatever, 40 pounds on me. And so you're not hitting the concrete. You know, and that was just kind of a real eye-opener for me. It was like, what am I doing? Why am I allowing myself to be in these situations and be treated like this? And I really feel like it was God, you know. It was that next day I went and I sat at home and I was like, that's it. And I really, truly feel that that was God, my higher power, tapping me on the shoulder, saying like, that's it, child, you know, the gig is up, you're done. And I decided to go to treatment because I had gone to AA. Oh, I didn't put that in there. But after that first initial meeting, in between those years, I did go back and go to a few AA meetings. But, you know, I would sit in the meetings and think, like, when am I going to go have a drink? You know, when is this thing over? So if you're new and you feel that way, I get it. Believe me, I've been there. But stick around, because this program works. It is a solution, you know. And I came out of treatment, and like they say, the real recovery begins after treatment. And that's so true. And somehow intuitively, I knew that going into it. I just knew that treatment was going to be a removal from my environment. I needed to get those 30 days. I needed to be away from my friends, the scene, you know. So people, places, and things, it's very important if you're new. My first year, you know, I stayed very close to the rooms. I made solid friendships. I built a foundation. You know, I didn't go out to bars. And the book talks about if we have right motives and we're spiritually fit, we can do those things. And I do those things now because I've worked the steps. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other people. I go to meetings. I have strong, you know, relationships with sober women. And this program is an absolute gift. It has, you know, to me, sobriety now, you know, that self-absorbed child with that fear-based thinking, that is still there. I still am selfish, and I still want to manipulate and control and get what I want in life. But I have a God, I have a program that allows me to live my life with spiritual principles. And that means showing up. That means taking others' needs into consideration, you know, and it means that without putting me in first and being the center of the universe, I actually get more back. You know, that saying about the giving, it's not about the giving, it's in the receiving. It really, really is true, and it works. So if you're new, please just keep coming back. We are glad that you're here, and thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Rick.
I think it's right. Good evening, everybody. My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober tonight by the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Heidi for inviting me to come and share with you tonight some of my experience, strength, and hope. I am... What's funny? She's laughing already. I am... I'm not a funny guy. So, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we share in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And that was explained to me early on, that really what was demonstrated to me, when I came to AA, I thought I was different. I was 19 when I attended my first AA meeting, and I thought I was way too young to be an alcoholic. An alcoholic to me was a drunk in a gutter someplace with a paper bag and a trench coat, or, you know, the other image I had was a woman middle-aged in a frumpy quilted bathrobe with cigarette burns, you know, with the curtains drawn. I don't think either of those are necessarily incorrect images, but alcoholism covers a lot more ground than that. Anyway, but as I listened to the stories of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to relate to what they were sharing and how they were sharing about not only the way that they drank, but the way that they felt. And I think both of the other speakers shared a little bit about that earlier tonight. I'm not from New York City originally. I'm the last of four kids. I grew up in the suburbs of Minneapolis. There was drinking in my household all the time on a regular basis. No alcoholism in my immediate family, although I have some kind of, you know, if you shake our family tree, they drop out. But my parents drank every day. My dad dad would come. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and my dad would come home from work, and they would have a couple of drinks before dinner. And I used to get the cherries out of their Manhattans, and I never particularly liked the way that they tasted. But I knew that that was something that adults did, was drink. And I had sips of beer and a little wine here and there. You know, there was always that kind of stuff. There was a bar upstairs in our house above the refrigerator and a full bar downstairs. So there was, you know, when people came to our house and there was drinking, it really was conviviality and fun and enjoyment. That was not crazy, drunken brawls or messes or that kind of thing. So I just knew that I was going to drink when I grew up. It was just, you know, one of those things that adults did. I also grew up, my dad was kind of a strict disciplinarian, and I grew up with that sense of I need to do everything perfectly. I was a physical coward, just afraid of everything and everybody. I wanted people to like me. I just didn't know how to say the right thing, do the right thing. I'm turning 50 next month. And one of the things, I'm having a little open house, and so I started looking for pictures of myself as I was growing up. And I've always referred to myself as a fat little kid, and I wasn't, you know. But that was really my perception. My perception was I was fat, I didn't fit in, I was awkward, you know. At one of my first AA meetings, a guy named Pete, who was, he was probably my age now, I was, you know, in my early 20s, but he was an older guy. He got up and he said, I never felt like I fit in. I never, you know, I was always an awkward kid. He said, you know, when we were playing sports in gym class, the teacher would pick the team captains, and then the team captains would pick the other kids in the class, and they'd pick everybody, and then they'd pick the blind kid, and then they'd pick the girl on crutches, and then they'd pick me. And that really was the way that I felt about myself. I always knew that I was a liability on your team, and I knew you didn't want to be around me. And I wanted so desperately for people to like me. I just didn't know how to do that. Because I was so concerned about what other people were thinking of me, I didn't talk very much, because I thought if I just kind of blend into the wall, nobody will really notice. So I was a very quiet kid. I was kind of bookish. I escaped into books early on. I watched a lot of TV. And I kind of got through school fairly easily. But it was really any kind of interaction with other people was painful to me. So I met this girl in junior high school, and she kind of adopted me and took me along, and we were kind of boyfriend and girlfriend for a while until she found out that I wasn't really interested in girls that much, and then we weren't boyfriend and girlfriend, but she was still kind of my friend and dragged me along. And she introduced me to a couple of other people, and we went out drinking one night. She wasn't with us that night. It was another guy that she had introduced me to and his girlfriend. We went out drinking in her, I think she was a Monza, and around the gravel pits west of Minneapolis. Jay had got a bottle of rum, and we were drinking rum and Dr. Pepper. And that was the first night that I got drunk. I drank enough that night that kind of feeling hit me, that warmth just hit me in the chest and kind of spread through my whole body. And I felt wonderful. I felt like I was in the place I was supposed to be, with the people I was supposed to be with, doing what I was supposed to do. All of that concern, all of that fear of what other people thought about me just kind of melted away with that drunkenness. And I just thought, this is what I want. This has been what I was kind of looking for all along. And I'd read self-help books. You know, my parents, you know, I hit puberty in the 70s, and that my parents read a lot, and so they had a lot of self-help books around. I read I'm Okay, You're Okay, and Games People Play. And Barbara Walters wrote a book called How to Talk to Anybody About Anything. And since I didn't know how to talk, I thought that was going to be the solution, but it didn't really change anything. And I didn't turn into a blabbermouth or the life of the party when I drank. I just felt comfortable. I felt like I was the person I was supposed to be when I was drinking. That night, we stopped the car, and I got out of the car, and I pissed in the middle of the street, and I just thought, this is living, you know. It was so freeing. I just love that effect. And I drank to get that effect. And I just assumed that everybody got that effect when they drank the way that I drank. And I didn't realize that there's, you know, most of the population of the world doesn't get that, you know. There's a small percentage of us who belong in Alcoholics Anonymous, of the whole people in the world. When I drink, I want to drink a lot because that's what gets me that good feeling. My family started, there was not a lot of alcohol. I have three siblings. I'm the last of four kids. And so a couple of years ago, my brother built a lake place. And so we go up there for the 4th of July. And they started making mojitos, which is this drink that I don't think any self-respecting drunk would want to drink because it takes about 20 minutes to make one. And who's going to wait for that? But anyway, he says in the afternoon, does anybody want a mojito? And then he gets down the glasses and he pulls the rum down off the bar and he gets out the fresh mint and the sugar and a little stick that he's got specifically to mash all that in the, you know, it takes forever. And then they have one mojito and he puts the bottle of rum back on the shelf and it's there for the next time. And that's just not the way that I drink. If the top's coming off, I want it to stay off because I want to have all of that. I had a very high tolerance for alcohol kind of early on, and I liked strong drinks. If we could get hold of 151 rum, that's what I wanted to drink. I started finding people who were having parties and started getting invited to parties. Never really was the life of the party. I was kind of a quiet hanger-on. I graduated high school and went away to college, somehow thinking that when I got away to college, when I moved up to Moorhead, Minnesota. If you've seen the movie Fargo, you have an idea of where that is. It's just flat. But I just thought that I was going to become the person that I was supposed to be there, that I was somehow going to blossom and become, you know, all my fears were going to fall away and all that loneliness and all that feeling of not being a part of and feeling of less than was going to disappear. And it did kind of in the excitement of being there. But after a short time, that all started to kind of creep back in. Somebody threw a party up there, and I went to that party, and I got drunk, and I realized that booze would do the same thing for me in Moorhead as it had done for me in Minneapolis. And I started finding those people who were having parties. I went to the world's largest Tom Collins party. They mixed it up in this big thermos, paid my money, and sat in the corner and got drunk. That was the first night that I blacked out. I had chunks of time just disappeared out of the night. I don't know where they went. I found myself riding up and down in an elevator in another dorm. I was going to college. I woke up with a pumpkin in my bed the next morning. It was about this time of year. I didn't know what had happened, and my life was so full of secrets. I was so afraid that you would find out who I was or what I had done, and I really hadn't done a lot, you know, a little shoplifting. I was, you know, I was gay, and I was really afraid that people would find out about that. I was a liar. I was stealing stuff. I was, you know, lying to my parents. I was thieving from my mom's purse, but there was not really a lot of big stuff, but everything was hidden, and that night after that first blackout, I didn't know what I had said or who I had told. I thought about committing suicide. I was so afraid that something might have gotten out. And I was so freaked out that first time that I blacked out. They became kind of a regular thing. By the time that I got to AA, I was blacking out almost every time that I drank. It just became a regular thing. A couple years later, I didn't get my dorm application in on time. I wound up living off campus and looking for an apartment off campus. I went up to school and I hung out with some folks that I had kind of taken up a drinking acquaintance with, and we started drinking in the early afternoon, and they were talking about going to a party. We were talking about going to the party and drinking and talking about going to the party and drinking. And at one point in the evening, I said, are we ever going to go to this party? And somebody turned to me and said, we went to that party, and you drove. It was really the first, you know, really only time that I recall somebody telling me what I had done at a blackout, because I really didn't hang out with people. I went to bars by myself. I drank by myself. I was not a big crowd guy. Anyway, so I went away to college, and you know, I intended to be a good student. I intended to be a, you know, all that kind of stuff. And my life just shrank down. I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. Drinking became more and more important. And what had started out as kind of once a month when I moved up to college turned into every week. And then I started arranging my college classes so that I didn't have, you know, Wednesday was only choir and it was at 11 o'clock. So Tuesday night is really like a weekend night I can party. And partying just became kind of the normal thing for me to do. And even at the end, you know, I was blacking out, I was throwing up, I was wet in the bed, you know, drinking was, it was causing some consequences for me, but being sober was even more painful. Being sober, I didn't know how to pay the bills, I didn't know how to balance my checkbook, I didn't want to have to go back to Hornbacher's grocery store and pay them, you know, do the humiliation of covering my bad check one more time. I didn't want to have to, you know, sneak around the booze store. It was the 70s, and I was going to college in a college town, and nobody was really carding, nobody was really paying much attention. I was underage, but anyway. So what happened was, you know, on the inside, I was dying. And Christy talked about the fact that alcoholism isn't just drinking. It is, for me, emotional and spiritual, as well as that physical sensitivity that I have to alcohol. Once I pick up a drink, I don't know what's going to happen. But that doesn't happen for most people. And, but on top of that, my emotions are a little out of whack. And that kind of selfishness and self-centeredness kind of keeps me on the edge of everything all the time. So anyway, I went on a four-day drunk weekend. I was hanging out with this girl, and she had been spending a lot of time with me as my drinking progressed and saw that there was something wrong with my drinking and suggested that, sat me down with her landlady who worked at a mental health place, suggested I might want to check out AA. And I knew there was something wrong with my life. Like, when I lay down to go to sleep at night, I couldn't, you know, everything just kind of turned in my head and churned, and I couldn't shut it off. I didn't know how to get to sleep. I didn't know how to get out of bed in the morning. I couldn't keep my commitments. You know, I was going to college, but it was hit or miss if I was going to get to a class or not. I didn't connect any of that with drinking, but somebody made that connection for me. She suggested that I go to AA, and they introduced me to this woman who was in her 40s, you know, she seemed ancient to me at the time. And I, you know, I somehow had the idea that I could still control my drinking, that drinking wasn't really the problem, that something else was the problem, something wrong with me. Anyway, I started going to some AA meetings, and I know that I was hearing the suggestions that were given to me when I got sober. People were talking about getting a sponsor. People were talking about having a home group. People were talking about not drinking one day at a time, but I somehow couldn't make that connection. I was going to meetings kind of haphazardly. I didn't want to ask anybody to be a sponsor because I was so afraid of everybody. And so finally, I kind of badgered this woman who took me to my first meeting into agreeing to be my sponsor. She said, you know, men sponsor men and women sponsor women in AA. But I was so afraid to ask anybody else that she finally grudgingly agreed to be my sponsor. I didn't talk to her, so it didn't matter really whether I had a man or a woman. So I wasn't really doing anything that AA was suggesting, and I find myself picking up a drink over and over again. I could go a couple weeks, I could go a few days, but I at some point had gone past the point where I could decide whether I was going to pick up a drink or not. Once I started to drink, I didn't know what was going to happen. And I did that for about 11 months, kind of went to AA off and on, and tried to stop drinking. And what happened was September 13th, 1980, I was driving home drunk in the middle of the night. And I'd been hearing about alcoholism as a progressive illness. I'd been hearing about the way that people drank. I could see that my drinking had changed even over the short period that I had been drinking. I drank for about 5 years. On the way home that night, there was like a voice that spoke to me that said, "You have alcoholism and it's going to kill you." And I accepted it that night. I surrendered to the fact that I had alcoholism. And I really surrendered, I think, that night to the fact that I was willing to do what Alcoholics Anonymous suggested for me to do. That idea that I was different somehow because of the smartness or the gayness or the youth, all of that kind of went away, and I knew that I was an alcoholic. and one of the things that I'd, one of the analogies that people used to use when I was newly sober was they used to say that being alcoholic is like being pregnant. You either are or you're not. It's just that the further along you are, the more it shows. And that may be a dumb analogy, but it's one of those things that has stuck with me all along, you know. And I realized that I was, and I became willing to have something different happen. And about the same time that that was going on, God put some people into my life. There was a group, a very active group in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and with a bunch of young guys who were still in college, and I ran into that group of folks, and ran into a guy who got my phone number at a meeting and started calling me and inviting me to coffee and inviting me to meetings. And as we went to coffee, he began to sponsor me even before I asked him to be my sponsor. He started sharing his experience, strength, and hope in Alcoholics Anonymous, talking about the way that he had practiced the steps, talking about the things that he was doing to stay sober in AA, being involved in having a home group. And that group of guys and that sponsor really became kind of the backbone of my sobriety and gave me the suggestions that are really the things that I try to practice today. So my last drink was September 13th, 1980. So I've just celebrated 29 years of sobriety about a week ago. And that to me is a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Left to my own devices, I was thinking about suicide on a regular basis. I was driving drunk. I was pretty sure that I was going to die. I just didn't know when or how. And I'm grateful to be alive and still sober in AA. The guys that I got sober with, they had a little mantra. They used to say, you know, don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor. Don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor. And it was they'd used to say to ask, what's the story? And we had to recite, don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor. And that's really still kind of what I do today. I was 19 when I got sober. I kept thinking, if I don't drink, I was 20 when I got sober, just short of my 21st birthday. If I don't take another drink for the rest of my life, that's 50, 60 years without a drink. I mean, it just seems so deadly dry and dull. And they told me to take it one day at a time. And even at the end of my drinking, I wasn't drinking every day. So I knew that it was possible to go one day. And so I started hanging around these guys. They said, you know, the other suggestions really will help you not pick up a drink one day at a time. They said, get a home group, a meeting that meets the same time, the same place every week. They used to say, don't miss that meeting unless there's a death in the family, your own. And so these guys were all members of the Moorhead Thursday Night Group, and so I became a member of the Moorhead Thursday Night Group. And we went there early, and we did service. We set up coffee. We had ashtrays at that in those days. It was in the basement of the Moorhead Center Mall. You used to take an elevator down, and by the time meeting time came around, when the elevator doors opened, there was smoke down to waist high. But there was a lot of laughter in that group. It had been started by a man who got sober in 1948, and he was still sober when I got sober. He was, you know, got sober before I was born. He was a very active, involved member of Alcoholics Anonymous, served as a GSR and a delegate and a trustee to the General Service Board. So I was introduced to General Service in Alcoholics Anonymous fairly early on. And the guys that I got sober with, in addition to going to that home group on Thursday night, went to other meetings during the week. And so we kind of traveled as a band. There were a group of us who went together. And I started to lose that sense of isolation. You know, not right away. I was telling the story. We used to go, after the meeting, they'd go to Cher's Kitchen, which was a kind of a 24-hour family dining place. And there'd be 8 or 12 guys sitting at one or two tables, and they'd be laughing and talking about how great sobriety was and how wonderful things were going, and, you know, sharing about, you know, how they were staying sober through tests and you know, breaking up and getting together with girlfriends you know, how they were dealing with life sober, bringing God into the relationships that they were in, talking about practicing the steps in all of their affairs and making amends. And it was, you know, it was an amazing time to kind of be there as they were sharing those things. But I was still kind of very isolated. I used to excuse myself and go play video games in the lobby, you know. They used to say, oh, Miss Pac-Man was your first sponsor. But But I was really still so uncomfortable that even while I was hanging out with them, I still had to get away from time to time, but they kept inviting me along, and I'm so grateful that they called me and didn't wait for me to call them, because if they had sat by the phone waiting for me to call them, they'd still be waiting. I just did not know what to say. And thank God they told their stories over and over and over again and welcomed me along, and eventually I did my fourth step and did my fifth step, and I lost some of that feeling of being different and unique and some of that fear of people finding out about me, and I started to be able to share a little bit. I was about 2.5 years sober. I moved to South Dakota. I didn't graduate from college. I went to Germany to do student teaching, and I realized that I was afraid to stand up in front of a group of people, and I hadn't paid any attention in my education classes, even sober, so teaching wasn't really a good occupation for me, so I wound up working in a fast food restaurant, actually for 6.5 years after I first got sober. So, and that's where I moved to South Dakota. And when I moved to South Dakota, it was really kind of the time that I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was in Moorhead, there was a group, sometimes 13, 14 guys who used to go to coffee and do 12-step work together and call newcomers. And they were really very active, and I kind of tailed along on their coattails. When I moved to South Dakota, that group wasn't there. And so there was one guy from our group who had moved to South Dakota before me and started a little group. And so I became a member of the Watertown Monday Night Group. And there was a little crew of us. But I had to start to call newcomers myself. I had to start to do some of those things on my own. It was the first time that I had a full-time job. I was 23. My parents gave me my first car, which was my sister-in-law's Pinto station wagon hand-me-down. I was a couple years in Watertown with that car, and I'd been saving up some money. It was really the first time that I became self-supporting through my own contributions. I was getting ready to buy a new car, and I'd been in AA. I'd heard about the traditions and was kind of experiencing those kind of on a one-time basis. The seventh tradition for me has a real meaning because I relied on my parents through this whole time. They paid for my schooling, my room, my board, everything. And I hated them, really, kind of up until I did my fourth step, and then I started being willing for that resentment to go away, and eventually it did after some more time and making amends and spending some time with them. But at this time, it wasn't really it was cordial but not loving, particularly from my end of things. But one of the things my sponsor said was, you know, and I don't know if anybody saw the movie Torch Song Trilogy, there's a line in there where a woman says to her son, "You cut me out of your life, and then you blamed me for not being there." And it just wounded. I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what I did to my parents. But anyway, I only contacted them when I wanted money, basically, for several years. Until I moved to South Dakota, I got this job. I'm working, not making a lot of money, but I was starting to save up some money. I was getting ready to buy a new car. And my parents and I talked about the fact that I was getting ready to buy a new car. And unsolicited, they sent me a check for a down payment on a new car. And I talked to my sponsor, and I wrote them a nice note that said, "I really appreciate your being willing to help me with this, but it's about time that I became self-supporting through my own contributions." I cried when I put that check back in the mail. But I can't tell you what a difference that made in our lives, in my life and in the relationship that we had together. Both my parents have passed away since I got into AA. I moved back to Minneapolis in 86 and spent some time with them on a regular basis. My mom died very suddenly in 1991, and my dad, a few years later in 99, passed away from a brain tumor. And I was there when my dad passed away, and we had time to make amends and have really some tremendously loving and close time together. And I'm really grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for that, for the example of other people who made amends in AA, and for the principle that's what we do here. I don't know that I would have gotten over that resentment, but it's one of the things that we do here is we have that example of what happens with other people when they do those things. And I'm really grateful for that. Anyway, I moved back to Minneapolis. I got a new sponsor. So and got a new home group. Those are really, in those things, having a home group and having a sponsor have been kind of anchors for me throughout my whole sobriety. They've been the things, going to meetings regularly, talking to newcomers, seeing new people come in. It's amazing to me the number of people who have under 90 days tonight who are here at this group. You never have to pick up a drink again. You can live the rest of your life sober one day at a time if that's what you choose to do. Stick with the people who are here. There are people who are sober who will show you how to do that. We take the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's our program of recovery, you know, one step at a time. It's not rocket science. There's a line in Bill's story that said, says simple but not easy. You know, a price has to be paid. It means self-sacrifice has to, self-sacrifice and kind of like giving up the me first thing, which is an ongoing struggle for me, because I'm on my mind all the time. I'm thinking about me. Coming to meetings, talking to newcomers, it's one of those things that gets me out of my head. It gets me out of my own way. It allows a channel from what I believe is I call it God because I don't have a better idea for it. I grew up Episcopalian. I'm not an Episcopalian anymore. I still like going to church. That's not my thing on a regular basis, but there is something for me, there's something that I feel when I'm doing what's suggested for me to do in AA that lifts me up, that makes me whole, that fills me up, that cleans me out, and I'm really grateful for that. So if you're new, stick around one day at a time. You don't have to tackle everything all at once. Easy does it, but do it. It's, the slogans for me have been particularly helpful. But also the willingness to hang around the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, to see their example, to hear what they've gone through, to be willing to try some of the things that they suggest. I still have a home group today. I moved to Manhattan about almost 10 years ago, which is unbelievable to me. I'm living in New York City, which is kind of a dream that, from where I came from and the experience that I have doesn't seem like a possibility, but here I am. I scored a suite apartment on 72nd Street on the West Side. When I moved to New York, one of the difficulties that I had was getting used to AA here. I actually got sober in a group that's much more like this group in its enthusiasm and its service ethic and the idea that we're here to really help newcomers and focus on carrying the message and talk about the big book and not only talk about it but do the things that are included in it. I don't want to disparage my home group, but I love my home group. But one of the things that when I moved here was that I didn't come to this group, but I didn't find AA to be particularly welcoming. And I ran into a group where there were people who were going out to coffee after the meeting, where there was a fellowship outside the meeting. The group was not just a group that met once or twice a week, but a group that was a spiritual entity that carried its message even after the group meeting was over. And I am truly grateful for that. So they suggested to me when I was new that if I did what was suggested for me in AA, I'd feel clean inside and good things would happen in my life. That is truly what has happened. I still struggle with self-doubt. I have, relationship troubles. I have all the human troubles that a person can have. I've got them, and sometimes I think I got them in spades. But I know that coming to Alcoholics Anonymous gives me the clarity to be able to find out what I need to do about them. Sometimes the solution for me has not been in AA, but has been through some outside help. But AA has been kind of the rock that allows me to find out what that help needs to be. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm glad to be sober today. If you're new, don't drink today. Find a sponsor. There are tons of them here in this room tonight. Get a home group and keep coming back. Thanks so much.